Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
I'm going to kind of play like Statler and Waldorf, a little bit of the movie at times, too. Like those two guys.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie isn't even really interested in letting us know who they are, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. But...
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by goddamn near everybody.
That's right.
We got Barrett Sher, we've got Jonathan Watkins, and we've got Aaron Dicer, all from the things that we do.
Hello.
And today we're going to be doing a mini pod of The Trial of the Chicago 7, the new Aaron Sorkin movie that is on Netflix right now. Where do we want to start on this one?
Where to start? Well, it's Aaron Sorkin and Aaron Sorkin, right? Writer, director.
It is.
The time he's done this is Molly's Game, which we all like, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
I will say right off the bat that Aaron Sorkin, the director, gets in the way of Aaron Sorkin, the writer. And he's done this the last two times.
I totally agree.
Molly's Game has a lot of indulgences in it that I love Molly's Game, and I love me some poker and some gambling and all that. But there's something about the way he goes about that movie that's like, you could have trimmed this, you could have trimmed that. And in this movie, it's even worse, possibly.
Ooh, interesting. I think it's better, this movie. But
oh, my God. There's so many things that he needs to cut out of this movie. So many. I don't know how many times that we have to know that, that this judge is awful, and like he keeps giving the same ruling about the same thing over and over and over again. I don't know why we need that. It seems like to me it's pretty well established early on that we don't, you know, I don't know. I mean, I it's almost like, look, I feel like there should be a lot of Bobby Seale in this movie. There should be more story. There should be, he should be told he's not a part of the seven that's in this title.
Mm-hmm.
But man, how many times do we have to hear, I don't have my lawyer. I don't have my, I want my lawyer. I want this and that. How many times we got to hear that?
I thought that was handled about the appropriate amount of times.
You think?
Yeah, I do. Because he's really developing, and in fact, if you look at the real life case, this judge was apparently even worse, crazier and even more racist, and you know, the stuff that I read at least. And so Sorkin's actually kind of dialing him back, I think, because you know, in a movie, it would seem, you know, too scenery chewing to make
exactly,
him that real or whatever.
Exactly.
But But yeah, because especially the Bobby Seale part, like that has to be such a primary part of especially the first, you know, half to three quarters of this trial. And so, yeah, understanding that lawyer thing, I think, drives a little bit of the tension. You know, there's a moment early on. Well, I guess we don't want to get into spoilers, but for a historical movie. But
let me stop you right there. I think we could probably get into spoilers throughout this. This is a real thing that happened. And I don't think we need to keep anything secret, do we?
I don't know. I was just, you know, sometimes moments. I don't want to know moments
know the story of this, the way Sorkin tells it, there are revelations about what's going on.
Okay.
And everything. My point is that I don't think you had to do it as many times as you did. I think you could do a couple of things at the beginning, and then when the trial gets on to trial, you know, day 190 or whatever, that's when you can say it once again, and you can be like, as a viewer, you can say, oh my God, 190 days, he still doesn't have his own lawyer and they're still treating him like this. It feels like I got that down. It's not the only thing in this movie too, by the way,
sure,
that does that over and over and over again. Getting the names wrong, you know, he keeps getting the names wrong. But anyway, there are some other indulgences in here that we'll get to. That, you know, that are really like, this is where Sorkin gets in his, like, gets bad at times, especially at the end of this movie. But anyway, this is what I liked. I liked all the performances in this movie. Mm-hmm. Eddie Redmayne pulls off a great, like, a different kind of an American accent. In this, mm-hmm. A lot of the British people come over, they don't do like an accent. They do this stock thing, which is what Sacha Baron Cohen's doing in this movie. Has a stock kind of an American accent and everything. But I like Sacha Baron Cohen a lot in this. He's one of the highlights. Eddie Redmayne's great. Jeremy Strong has become one of my favorite actors.
He's a goddamn trip in this movie.
He is. Jeremy Strong has become one of my favorite actors. He's in Succession. He's in The Big Short. He's in a lot of stuff, but he's become one of my favorite people to watch.
When he's asking if the FBI agent asked about him, I was dying.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I thought that's something. I had a thing. I'm so sorry. I'll do that again. What?
I was like, where are you going with this?
No, I had all of a sudden this thing popped up. It was saying your mic's turned off, and I didn't. It was just, it caught me off guard. So I thought you guys couldn't hear me all of a sudden.
No, I was sitting there anticipating what you were wanting to say next. Anyway. And I was like, yeah, FBI guy, right?
He's asking he's asking Joseph Gordon-Levitt, right? I think he's mm-hmm. asking if she ever asked about him. I just that scene is genuinely great. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I think in general, if I'm picking up your vibe, Chris, I think I enjoyed this a lot more than you. I really did love this movie. But those kind of moments are just, it's what I love about Sorkin. Just the way he writes moments, the way he writes characters' dialogue, the way, you know, the verbal sparring that goes on. And there's just, I watched it a second time recently, and I found myself looking forward to, oh yeah, this is where this happened. Oh yeah, this is where this guy says this. And there's just something about Sorkin movies where that rewatchability factor is just like amped all the way up. And I think this one's better than Molly's Game, because I think he's more able to focus in on the story he wants to tell. Molly's Game was a bit messy. You could tell it was kind of the first time he had, you know, control over the directing part of it. But I think he's getting better, and I'm excited to continue to see if he can get out of his own way, like you say, completely. And
it definitely isn't the dialogue in the back and forth that I would take issue with.
Yeah, yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah,
I'm talking about some other things that we'll get to. But
oh no, totally. Especially the end.
My head nearly just slammed the table when that fucking shit happened at the end.
Yep.
But So I guess what you want to do a little bit of background on this at all. It's about seven people who are from three different groups. The Tom Hayden, is it Tom Hayden is his name?
Mm-hmm.
He's a part of what is that? Is it a democratic society of some sort? Group's name?
It's the president of he's the president of the Students for a Democratic Society.
Yeah. SDS. And so, yeah. So you have him, and then you have like Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin are both part of these Yippies, mm-hmm. this Yippies group. And then you have the Black Panthers that are involved that are in this, but they weren't arrested for the same thing. They were all basically arrested to, and they, as they say, it's a political trial, but nobody who's official wants to call it a political trial, even though that's what it completely is. And they want to be made an example of and everything. I do like how there's a point where they point to two of the guys who aren't even like really a part of anything. They want to make examples of us, the people who are visible, and the two of you, they're going to say are not guilty so that they can look good later and say that they're being fair about everything. And yeah, these two other guys are just kind of like, why are we even here?
Yep. You know, it's the kind of play like Statler and Waldorf, a little bit of the movie at times too. Like those two guys.
Oh yeah.
And the movie isn't even really interested in letting us know who they are, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's these three different factions of people want to come to Chicago, and they want to march. They want to have a festival of love and lights and things like that. And it just so happens that they all sort of converge around. Is it Lincoln Park is where they end up?
No, it's Grant Park in Chicago, and they're specifically there to protest the war in front of the Democratic National Convention, which was held at the Hilton that maybe you stayed at one time, right there across from the Michigan Avenue from the park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, because there's this whole, like, you know, this idea that these protesters might go in start some real violent trouble and everything, that's when like the Chicago Army is brought in, mm-hmm. basically. And then the whole question is whether who started it first, right? The protesters or the police. The movie has a kind of an ambiguous answer to that, right?
I don't think it's very ambiguous. There's a moment, especially, we haven't mentioned Michael Keaton yet, but Michael Keaton has the moment that disambiguizes it. If that's
I'm gonna tell you what, guys. You guys may have come at the end of this going, "Oh yeah, we've definitely solved this at the end." But I think that the way this movie's portrayed, I was confused as to who actually started all of this.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because of the way they did this. And I rewound that part where they're talking about, you know, the speech that happens and everything. And I was just like, wait a minute, what are they saying? I don't know what, and I must have missed something. I don't know what it is. but anyway, do we want to just go ahead and like grade it and go to spoilers? Or
yeah,
what?
Let's do that.
Sure.
And Jonathan, do you have anything to say before we get into spoilers?
No, I mean, I guess I can go first and grade it if you want. I'll just say that I thought this movie was very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I was never like bored or anything. I had a really fun time watching this. I think this is a movie I'll be able to watch multiple times in my future. Like Aaron was just pointing out a lot of that, though. Just Aaron Sorkin's dialogue always just slays me. Mm-hmm. And God, Mark Rylance, who we haven't even said. I mean, there's so many good performances in this movie, yeah. Right? So Mark Rylance might be my favorite. Mm-hmm. He's just, and I don't know that I saw Bridge of Spies, so I guess I have seen him, but I don't know. He absolutely blew me away. I did like Sacha Baron Cohen, who I rarely like. So that was fun. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is also someone I typically don't like that much, but I enjoyed him here. I will say his character, talk about not really being ambiguous. I thought his character was really confusing. like his motivations and why he was doing what he was doing. We can get more than that in spoilers, I guess. But no, I mean, it was a super entertaining movie. I give it a B plus.
Mm. All right.
Nice. I can go next. I am currently hovering between an A and an A minus. The end is, I think, enough for me to go down to an A minus. I've wrestled with this a lot. For 90% of this movie, I'm in an A and just loving it and having a great time, enjoying the performances, love what it has to say. And then the end that we shall talk about here in a bit, just my eyes started rolling. And I'm like, wait, my eyes haven't been rolling this entire movie. Why are you making my eyes roll now? So the end brings it down a little bit for me. So
my thing, though, A-. I'll say with the B plus, though, the reason I can't quite get to an A, because an A or A minus to me would be like for a story. That's Social Network. That's A Few Good Men. This movie doesn't get there, especially because of that ending. But that's the only reason I took it down a little bit.
Yeah, that's the Pixar problem, right? Like when you have so many good movies, you don't know how to rate the okay ones. Yeah.
I'm going to pretty much echo what Aaron said. For me, the beginning of this movie is a little more problematic. The end is the end, whatever. But it was just muddled at the beginning. There was too much being thrown at me. And I think that's an example of what Chris was saying of Sorkin, the director, getting in the way of Sorkin, the screenwriter, at least to me. But the rest of the performances, the rest of the interactions, the rest of I quite liked interspersing the riot footage, the actual riot footage with the staged version. So this is absolutely an A for me. I love this and I will watch it many, 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 many times.
I thought you disliked this movie because almost always when you say I want a mini pod, I've got stuff to say, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, I absolutely love this movie.
That's awesome.
You're right. There's a rewatchability, Aaron, that's the same to me as A Few Good Men and Social Network and stuff like that. I'm not ready to put this movie in that echelon, but I could see myself watching this over and over and over again. There's certain personal things to me. This was a Chicago movie. There's certain timeliness to this movie, given where we are as a society here in 2020. So, yeah, this hit home in my brain and my heart and my belly button.
I'm going to give this a B. The performances are great. I don't think this movie's anywhere near. And we can't, I don't grade this based on the fact that it's not Social Network or A Few Good Men or anything. I just think that the movie is a B, and I think that, and I have been wrong before, but I think this movie's forgettable in the end. I think it's going to be one of those 5 years from now, I'm going to be like, what happened in that movie? And it goes with a lot of that with biopics for me because, it's not a, I don't know. There was nothing in here. There might be dialogue moments that we can chew into and everything. There was no major events that happened in this that I find particularly memorable. It's a trial movie. And what I'm going to take out of this is that Frank Langella is playing a big old asshole. That's all I'm going to remember about this, I think. Now, 5 years from now, who knows? I'll be like, hey, guys, you remember Trial of Chicago 7? That movie's really good. I didn't know if you knew that or not.
Here's my hot take in 2025.
Right, exactly. but for now, it was one of those movies that just didn't stay with me. After I watched this 2 days ago, and I was sitting there going, okay, what happened here? What was this? What was that? And I was like, oh, wait a minute. And then I started remembering things that irritated me about the movie more than stuff that I actually liked about the movie. So I planned on watching this again as well just before this, but I ran out of the clock. So right now I'm at a B, and I think that's a good grade for this movie. Let's go on to the so-called spoilers.
Basically, is Kaiser Sose.
Luke's father is actually Darth Vader. She's the sister and the daughter.
No. I'm reading the books.
There were two things that I brought up, and maybe you guys can, tell me. So the ending of the towards the end, you know, Michael Keaton, who was the former attorney general under Lyndon Johnson, they did an investigation of this, and they found out that the Chicago police were definitely the ones who started this riot. And I have no problem with that idea. But then when it gets to the speech, when Hayden is up there and he wants to say our blood is spilled on the streets, but then he says if blood is spilled on the streets, what was the confusion there? Was he supposed to say our blood, or did he say if blood?
He was supposed to say our blood, because
and he said if blood is spilled on the streets, then so it sounds like he's trying to incite everybody on the stage. And that's why I am wondering if the movie itself is saying, you know, yes, he said that, but that's not inciting a riot.
I think the movie is trying to say, A, that he's referring specifically to his buddy getting hit with the nightstick and bleeding all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I think that interaction between Abbie Hoffman and Hayden later on, where they do clarify, he's saying he's supposed to be saying our blood. You do that all the time, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. And when he's on the stand, he says he's also been saying, I want to end the war, but the guns haven't stopped shooting. So it's not like he's inciting this. The police preceded his statement that says, you know, that looks like it's inciting. And that's why the tape is so damning in the court of public opinion. So
what you're saying is the cops aren't even taking into account that his friend is getting beaten there or whatever. They know that. Either they do know that he's referring to that, and they're giving him a misleading tape, or they didn't know that, and it just sounded like to them, like out on the grass listening to this, that this was, hey, he's telling everybody to go after the cops, and everything, So that's where I was missing. That's where I was missing the thing, because the movie seems to be saying, yeah, I mean, it shouldn't have gotten to that point, but
yeah, no, but, and the tape is damning, and that's why he can't take the stand. Mm-hmm. Aaron, let me know if I'm getting this misinterpreted, but I think because if you hear that out of context, like Hoffman says, you know, it quotes the Bible verse, and he says you can take anything out of context, but it was preceded by his buddy getting whacked with a nightstick, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think the movie in my mind is saying that no, the police are to blame, but this tape does exist. And if you take it out of context, it's going to be, you know, legally shitty for your case.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting though. Go ahead. Sorry.
I think the issue that we're working around is, I think the movie has a very clear point of view about what happened.
Yeah.
But I don't think the movie gets explicit about how it happened. And so there's a little bit of, not necessarily yada yadaing, but when literally push comes to shove, we don't necessarily, you know, see exactly how it all goes down, but we throughout the movie are given signals of flashbacks of cops taking off their badges so they can, you know, beat people up. We, you know, have the Michael Keaton thing that you mentioned. So I think the movie's clear point of view is that a police state around this Democratic convention is the reason there was violence and bloodshed. I think that is the movie's opinion. And I don't think that's in doubt. What I think might be in doubt, Chris, and maybe what you're dealing with is, you know, the actual events of how it transpired get a little muddy there at the end, at least for me.
No, I totally agree that the movie itself is saying that, but they, right after that, right after Michael Keaton is on the stand, they do this confusing thing with him saying the wrong word. And then trying to follow what Abbie Hoffman is saying about his writing, I had no idea what the fuck he was talking about.
I also think the movie presents that what the wrong word thing in a really, really weird way. It's almost like they're trying to make that a twist. I mean, they are definitely trying to make that a twist. And that doesn't really make any sense because the, I'm sorry, what is the character's name? Tom Hayden. Mm-hmm. Tom Hayden would have told him that. Tom Hayden would have said, no, I meant to say this, like in a real conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like, I mean, Hayden knew what he meant to say. So the idea that Hoffman had to like bring that to light was really odd when Hayden was being questioned. We just watched Hayden get questioned for 5 minutes.
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. In an authentic real world way, it is very odd. In a movie way, it's very satisfying because we have been given this entire movie, we have been given the dissension between Hoffman and Hayden. It really is kind of the primary conflict of the movie is they have different ways of approaching how to get peace, of how to make a message. And the fact that Hoffman is the one that comes to his defense at the end because of his intelligence, because of Hoffman's intelligence, is really satisfying in a narrative way. And I think Sorkin's doing a pretty standard movie trick there to, you know, have those characters.
I think if you do that well, it's not as obvious as Sorkin made it. I don't know. There's something the last like 15, 20 minutes of this movie are very, that's where I start losing. That's where it starts losing points for me. The Michael Keaton character is a problem too, because they even present this as like, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt in that moment actually brings up really good points that nobody even addresses, where he's like, you know, he could just be trying to, you know, diminish the current administration because he doesn't like them. And that's very possible that that's the case. And that would have been interesting to look into. He also, what is it? He says, God damn it, I lost my train of thought. Levitt says, because they were saying, well, they decided that it was the fault of the Chicago police. And then Levitt says, but the current administration is the one investigating this, which is true. And so Keaton's testimony probably wouldn't be allowed.
Well, like, they had already run an investigation under the Johnson administration.
Yeah. The trial is based on that. I mean, I'm just saying that's a fair point, though, that he brings up legally.
I mean, that would be relevant information if the previous Justice Department
I agree with you that it would be, but I don't know that Levitt's wrong as far as the way the legal system works.
No, what I love about Levitt's character. Is it Gordon Levitt? It's Gordon Levitt because it's hyphenated, right? Yeah. That's what I love about his character is that I think he's clear cut as possible. He's like the Jack character, the Kevin Bacon character in A Few Good Men. He's in a bind. He has to do his job, but he doesn't believe that they're guilty of anything, but he still has to do his job, and he's going to fight like hell to do it.
I agree, but it's handled better in A Few Good Men. I think if Levitt didn't stand up at the end of the movie, that's the part that gets me, where I kind of like, I don't get this character at all, because I just don't believe that character would have stood up at that
moment. That's the only part of the end I like. When he gives honor to the reading of the names, I think that is valuable character work that's going on there, because he has been all along the person that's like, I don't like these guys. I don't agree with what they're doing. Politically, I'm on the other side of them, but I am going to try to be a man of integrity about the law process and actually do my job, but at the same time, be respectful of the process. And so that to me is like the culmination of his character.
I don't think the movie earns that moment at all.
I'm with Jonathan on this. This is the in and out moment where everybody stands up and says, I'm gay, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The movie. It's not the Spartacus moment. It's the in and out moment.
Not Spartacus. Yeah.
Yeah. But Spartacus, you could agree, is not ridiculous. And in and out
is. Exactly.
There's a difference. Let's have a line here.
But everything else about how that moment is handled is so schmaltzy. And, you know, the little kid with his dad, you know, is just, it's eye rolling. And here's the question. Do we really need slow clap moments anymore in movies? Like, aren't we past that? Can't we feel it without that? Or do they still work ever? Because when's the last time one worked, you know?
This one.
I don't know.
It worked for you. The end worked for you.
Of course.
I mean,
look, let's just... We know that shit didn't happen. It seems so false when he starts reading those names up. Now look, great moment, like movie moment, right? He's reading out the names. This is why we did this. They said that way off in the early part of the movie. But when he starts rattling that off, and then I'm just like, Langella is back there. I couldn't stop looking at him during this entire scene when he's reading these names out. He's like slamming that gavel. Yeah.
He's like, maybe the worst like, part of it.
Come yeah. on. You know, how in the world is someone in this courtroom going to be able to restore order? You know,
I will say if my memory is correct, and it may not be, but I did do a lot of, you know, diving into the trial itself afterwards. I think the reading of the names is a moment that happened in the trial. However, it happened like in the middle of the trial. It wasn't the end. It wasn't like it was a moment where I think pretty much how it's presented in the movie, where he was told, you know, to succinctly say something, and instead he started reading the names, you know, of those.
One thing that I read, so they never got to that. Like they never. Interesting. They wanted to memorialize, but they didn't. They couldn't get to it. They wanted to. They just didn't.
I don't mind him reading the names, though. I think that's kind of a nice moment because, like Chris said, they mentioned that a couple of times. I mean, they foreshadow it. So I don't have a problem with that, but I just wish that's where it ends. Like maybe while he's reading the names, that's when they go to each character and you see what they ended up doing. Or whatever, but you don't have all the people in the background standing up. You don't have Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I don't know. And you definitely don't have Frank Langella doing his bullshit,
whacking on a table. I mean, you mentioned slow clap moments. The end of A Few Good Men, which we all love, mm-hmm. is the you don't have to wear a badge on your shoulder to have honor. And he's like, Ten Hook, there's an officer on deck. That's as smalty as fucking gets, man. But yeah. I still love that movie.
That's still a nicer moment than this, though. I don't know why. That is cheesy, though. I agree.
It's a Time article that I read that says it happened on Vietnam Moratorium Day, was being observed by millions of Americans. That day, the defendants attempted to place American and South Vietnamese flags side by side on the defense table. Judge Hoffman unsurprisingly demanded they take them down. Whatever decoration there is in the courtroom will be furnished by the government. And I think things look all right in this courtroom. Very few of the soldiers' names were said aloud before the judge cut off the endeavor.
Well, I mean, and you know, look, the fact is in this movie, Eddie Redmayne is sitting there allowed to say the
right.
names
right.
over and over. Like nobody, like I guess all the bailiffs and everybody were like, I should be respectful too, you know?
Did Hoffman and Rubin really wear judges' cloaks?
Yes, that really happened.
That really happened?
Yes. Fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
There were some other, now look, like I said, performances in this are great. I like the message. I like a lot of things about this, but I keep coming back to things that I don't like. I hate it when they're going back and they're doing flashbacks and they'll show the footage of what went on at the park. And then they'll intercut it with people talking about what was happening. And then like, they'll go to Abby Hoffman doing his stand-up routine, like for like a couple of seconds. And it's like, I don't need to hear what you were fucking saying to tell the story. Give me one source for the story, please. Or like, just tell the story in the flashback. You don't have to keep coming back to people. You know, I know this is something that worked really well with The Social Network, but I don't think they had to go to a stand-up comedian in the middle of it, you know, to fill in like patches of the story like they did in this one. It was annoying. It was annoying to me every time that it happened.
I enjoyed it.
Of course you did.
I know. It's weird. I mean, everybody's got a taste, a thing. But he does, for me, it's breaking up the typical way movies do exposition. And like, he has this exposition cocktail thing that he does that it just works for me. I just like how he, you know, because there's a momentum to it for me where it's like, it feels like something's happening, even though I'm just being exposited at.
Exactly. And the score helps that too. Like the score starts because it's the score is non-existent for a lot of this movie, especially in the courtroom scenes. But once they start in on the multiple sources of the flashbacks, the score starts moving and everything. And like you, Aaron, this worked very, very well for me. I loved the stand-up bits because you saw how Hoffman was able to grab this audience and make a tragic thing where people are getting beaten down and gassed and stuff like that, make it into a comedy routine until he gets to the I need a second moment.
When he is allowed to speak for a long amount of time, I'm fine with it. But in the middle of it, where they're just like you're going back and forth between footage and people talking, and then just for 5 seconds, and then they went over and did this and blah blah, and then it's like it's too much at that point. Give me just him for a while, or you know, it's there's just too many sources being thrown at you all at once. That's all.
And my favorite stand-up routines are when comedians are just giving exposition. That's always yeah. really funny
if they can sure. do it if they can make it funny it yeah. works for me.
I mean, Lenny Bruce was able to do that, right?
No, that's true. And I don't know what Hoffman did. I don't know what his, you know, his stand-up things were, but that was just funny to me. But no, I think I'm somewhere in between. I like when movies try, if they have to have exposition, I like when they try to do different things to present it that way. But it also, I don't know, maybe it's just Sorkin's done this so many times, it's starting to feel almost complacent. And
yeah,
you know, I don't know.
To me, it's almost like Michael Bay exposition. That's how rapid fire that shit.
Oh, gotcha.
the you know, like I think of a scene in Armageddon where they're teaching the guys how they're going to fly and they're learning all the G forces and shit. We're going to flip you. And they show the plane flip and then we're going to do this. And then they show the plane do that. And then it's like, we're going to do this. And it's like, fucking A, man. God damn it. Just stay on one fucking thing. Just one, like for at least 10 seconds.
Comparison. That's not a, I yeah. like, you know, Aaron Sorkin really is kind of the Michael Bay of language in some ways. Like he loves words like Bay loves explosions. Like, mm-hmm. you know, that's, mm-hmm. it's, mm-hmm. that's not bad.
I just don't know. Like I really, and once again, I feel like after I said I really enjoyed this movie, I'm just taking negative slants at it, but I'm not, I don't mean to. I mean, I really did enjoy this movie, but I don't know that I like Aaron Sorkin that much as a director. I just don't know yet because sure. Molly's Game suffered. Molly's Game was too long. This was mm-hmm. at least a little shorter than Molly's. Not that much though, but this one didn't feel as long, I guess.
Agree.
Yeah, there's going to be a process with him. I mean, he's obviously yeah. like learning that you know, how to make a full length feature and everything, and maybe at one point he'll figure out, oh, I don't need this or that, and I can, you know, trim it and make it paste a little bit better.
He's not bad. I just don't know if I just like his, I mean, just his writing is what is stands out.
I agree. This was supposed to have been originally directed by Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. And, he was going to write the screenplay and Spielberg was attached to it. he's still attached to it. He's an uncredited EP, I think. That would have been really something to see. That may have been like a return to form for Spielberg, because this was in developmental hell for a long time. Sorkin kept at it, and he basically just said, fuck it, I'll just do it myself.
Tell you what, at this point, I'd rather have Aaron Sorkin direct it.
I can't argue with that.
I always root for Spielberg to have a return to form, but I don't think this movie would have done it.
Can we talk about specifically the performances? I think everybody's on board with the performances here. Rylance, even though there's a touch of his Ready Player One performance creeping in on this,
well, he's
still really good.
He's been doing that since Bridge of Spies. He's got that very kind and very like unassuming, you know, sound to him.
I totally forgot he was in Ready Player One.
Yeah. So you know, it's not surprising that he's playing this character.
I love the hair.
But he does play it off very well. Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't let his frustration, which I mean, it's hopeless. Everybody knows that it's hopeless every step of the way in this trial. But he doesn't let his frustration boil over, except for maybe a couple of times, and he'll rephrase something, even though it's just like this judge is being ridiculous. I think Frank Langella was fantastic as the judge, crazy as he was. But man, you bring in Michael Keaton for the cleanup hitter, and he only has probably 5 minutes, 6 minutes of screen time. But my favorite part in this movie, besides maybe when Hoffman is on the stand, is you've got to find some courage. And then he stands up to the Justice Department and he looks over and he's like, found some.
Just that whole moment, that's just like, so good. It's like they came and told me that if I said anything, you know, whoever would, you know, take me down. So I wanted them to be in the room so I could tell, you know, I could tell them to fuck off basically. And then I'll, when do you need me or whatever, you know, just so
he
amazing.
Corrects him to say, it's General Clark.
Yeah. Of the Michael Keaton stuff is great. The, you know, they call them in to talk to him at his house, and he's got the other two, you know, Nixon goons behind him, and you know, it seems like it's just going to go the wrong way. Right. Like they're here to tell you that, you know, you're going to say anything that you're going to say is going to be in front of them, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh man, he's not going to do it, is he? And then he just kind of turns right around on him, flips it.
Well, plus that's a great moment. That's kind of like the Harvard, president, you know, in Social Network, turning the tables on Armie Hammer.
The timeliness of this, by the way, is when he does get on the stand and he says, well, when you were working for Lyndon Johnson, he was like, I don't work for the president. And then he keeps saying, I don't work for the president. And you have to believe that that was probably part of his testimony. But God, think of how timely that is right now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no kidding. No, that's what that's what movies about different eras do, right? They slip in some modern sensibilities to make it more relatable. And who knows if he actually said that, I didn't work for the president or whatever. I mean, it is definitely a jab. You can't take it any other way.
There's a lot of this movie that reminds me of Black Klansman. In a way, both the current footage and the old footage and stuff like that, and how it's presented. Obviously, two very, very different movies, but there's a lot of overlapping content in those movies.
I also wanted to mention there's a few smaller roles too. John Carroll Lynch is really good in this. He's like Jeremy Strong with Chris. John Carroll Lynch is becoming like one of my favorite, especially character actors. Ben Shankman's really good. As the other attorney. I love that he has one of my favorite moments when they call out Frank Langella for being racist.
So
and
good.
He's like, you're the first person that's ever done that. And then Ben Shankman's like, we'll put it on record. I'm the second. And then I don't know how to say Yahya Abdul-Mateen. Yeah. Probably the best thing about Aquaman. honestly, but he's excellent as Bobby Seale.
You know what?
It's really a shame we've gotten this far and we haven't pointed out any of the amazing female performances in this movie. Oh wait, there are none.
That's right.
There are no females in this entire movie.
You know what? Actually scared the shit out of me there because I was like, oh yeah, I'm forgetting about Parker Posey or something.
No, not a single female of note in this movie.
No, it's like other than like The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing. I think I've never seen less of a female presence in a movie.
There is the undercover FBI.
Correct.
Yes.
That is
she's very good.
Yeah, she is.
Yes.
No, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. First of all, I loved him in Watchmen. That was fantastic.
Yep.
I thought he was... I know this annoyed you, Chris, but the fact that he kept saying, I have a lawyer... And the judge is like, well, yeah, there's one sitting next to you. And Rylance is like, just because I'm in proximity doesn't mean I have to represent somebody.
He's
saying over and over, I don't have my lawyer. I don't have my lawyer. This is an illegal trial. Mm-hmm. And I think having that said over and over again points to how ridiculous and how he's not heard. He's not heard at all. He can say it until he's blue in the face. Judge isn't going to do anything until that moment where he's gagged and bound. And even in that moment, he's got this proud type of demeanor. He's not beaten down or anything like that. This is like a strong dude. And he finally, and that speaks to Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character in that, you know, he finally says, dude, this ain't right. And that's where you see that he's a man of principle outside of that.
I would have preferred just the, you know, I'm not saying, you know, a lot of times when we say, like, I think that happened too often, I'm not going to be able to express myself the way I need to, but I think you should cut out a couple of the middle instances of that happening.
I got you.
And then you get toward, you still get to say it towards the end. Like I said, once you see that it is day 190, whatever it is, and he's still saying that, I have gotten the point. And there are other ways to go about that too, without rehashing it for 3 minutes every single time they show up on screen, where, you know, you could have the court reporter say something. What did he say on this day? I have not had my lawyer today. He's doing gallbladder surgery, blah, blah, blah. He's not my lawyer and all that, all the stuff, and just keep going over and over and over again. You could do that in kind of a montage in a way if you wanted to. It just felt like to me, I was like, every time we see this character, we're going to get the whole, he doesn't have his lawyer with him. And I agree, completely ridiculous. It is ridiculous. It wears it, it. I guess if the point is to wear on you as much as it wore on them, mission accomplished.
Yeah. And isn't there a time where the entire defendants, the seven, basically say he doesn't have a lawyer or he has a lawyer. So yeah
they go to the point where they don't give a fuck about the contempt charge. They're just like, you know, how many times we have to say this shit?
Well, he even says to the jury at one point, right, that the only reason he's there is because they want a scary black man to make them look worse or whatever, absolutely 100% true, probably.
Mm-hmm. There is in the real trial, he was bound and gagged for 3 days of trial.
Damn.
3 days of trial.
What year was this again?
68.
I think, yeah. That's insane.
So again, you can almost feel like Sorkin's like, guys, this thing was so crazy. I can't actually, it will seem stupid as a movie if I tell you how crazy this trial actually was. And you can feel him like dialing it back to a more like acceptable place. But yeah, when you read about the real stuff, that judge was a piece of work, man.
There's crazy. A part like when, you know, Rylance is like, he's like, we have a judge here that would getting away with things that you wouldn't get away with in Honduras. You know,
he declares
the jury tampering part was really interesting, too, where they're like, well, at least we've got juror, whatever it was, 3 and 7. And it's like, they just happened to get Black Panther threats. You know,
that is a good little seed that he throws in there where they said that they noticed that. She's reading James Baldwin and then like, I don't know how many minutes later, all of a sudden that juror is being thrown in as a, and you know, as she walks out, you know, that guy goes, keep reading James Baldwin. But like, the problem is that she read it right in front of everybody. And so those guys were able to pick out, obviously, you know, it's, they're the ones in the wrong here. I don't want to make it out to be that she is. But they knew to pick her out.
That's one that that I don't think is explained. It's certainly not Gordon Levitt's character that would do that. Schultz, I should say.
Yeah.
But Hoffman confronts him. And or no, is it Rylance confronts him?
He confronts
and says, I'm going to prove that you guys sent those letters. Doesn't seem like something that crew would have done, but I could have.
I think J.C. McKenzie's, who J.C. McKenzie is another great character actor. I think he's Thomas Moran. I think he mostly confronts Helm.
Yeah. He basically says, if I find out you did this, you'll see the other side of the court system in a way you never wanted to.
You can tell, like, at the end, I mean, they make it very clear that the Thomas Moran character is more on the side of, like, the police and everything. Because, he, after Joseph Gordon-Levitt stands up, he's like, what are you doing? And then he leaves. You know? Yeah. So.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not gay.
You never get me to admit that shit. Hey, gotta admit though, in In-N-Out, when Wilford Brimley says it, it's pretty hilarious.
Oh, it is.
I do like the
In-N-Out's kind of funny. I'm sorry, but that part's not good.
I like how not only how Chicago this movie is, but how Southside Chicago it is, because they're in Hyde Park, which is a very different Chicago than what you see, you know, normally with the Magnificent Mile and stuff like that, even in Grant Park. And it's funny, they're going into the Museum of the Museum of Science and Industry. And that's where Jeremy Strong has that great dialogue. He and Sacha Baron Cohen work so beautifully together in this movie. He's great. Like, you know, I stared at that thing for forever. I didn't get anything. And he's like, that was an installation. It's not a fucking painting. The Museum of Science and Industry.
You were the time where he's like, now you don't know what to do with the egg, do you? He's like, no.
I can't figure out who my favorite is. I said Rylance, but now when we talk about Jeremy Strong, I'm like, no, he was really great.
There's
like,
a perfect comedic moment where he's like, he's insulting Schultz. He's like, you sent this girl in to insinuate or whatever that is. And Hoffman looks at him like, what? And he's like, to ensnare. And he's like, oh, okay. I also thought that Hoffman, there's a couple of times where that London accent gets in there, but I think you get a really good Boston accent to mimic Hoffman, who seems like such an annoyingly magnetic dude. I would have loved and hated to know this person in real life.
Well, that's the thing. Sorkin does that, right? Like, a lot of his character, like, I mean, Daniel Caffey, I mean, a lot of his characters, like, they're assholes, right? Yeah, but they're still the smartest person in the room at times, you know? And I'm kind of curious if Sorkin is that person, because that's, or thinks he's that person.
Maybe. Well, he loved, his thing is proficiency porn, man. Like, he loves people being great at their job, no matter what their personality is. Like, he loves proficiency. And I think maybe that's the Judge Hoffman thing is, Judge Hoffman was so anti that he really, you know, wanted to portray that as much as possible, you know?
Well, when you have that moment where Hoffman, like we talked about it earlier, where Hoffman is revealing what Hayden meant to say, and then he's like sitting there criticizing Hayden for like his use of pronouns or whatever it is, you feel like that's Sorkin like getting out like some hostility he has towards grammar.
Possibly my favorite line in the movie is, "You'll have to give me a second. I haven't been put on trial for my thoughts before." It's delivered so well. Yeah, it's so perfect.
He calls him friend.
Friend. Yeah.
I rewatched that part
about three or four times. I swear to God,
I don't even really care if that's. I know that there's no way courts proceed that way. Like, I know there's no way like Hoffman would be allowed to keep talking about that Bible verse and stuff. Like, they would have just shut him down. I mean, you know, he would have said not relevant or whatever. But I love the way Sorkin writes courtroom scenes. I don't care if they're bullshit.
That's right.
If he just did courtroom movies, I'd be fine. Obviously, that's cool.
No doubt.
or that moment where the entire defense table is like overturned or whatever, or overruled.
Yeah.
So good.
And that's the thing, right? At this point, the judge realizes that the contempt thing doesn't even matter anymore. So he doesn't have any sort of vigor to keep handing them out because he knows that it's not doing anything. So even when they all decide to sit down, except for Eddie Redmayne in that one scene, he's not even saying, "Oh, wow, how disrespectful" or anything. He's just like, fuck it. At this point, I don't have any real power at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, probably one last question for you guys. Did you guys know anything about this case before you watched this movie?
No.
Knew nothing.
I didn't either. And how did we not know this?
this is a lot lately,
like,
man.
It's like that thing in Watchmen, though. It's like the incident in Watchmen.
The Tulsa race riots. Yeah. Black Wall Street.
Yeah. I mean, that was obviously a lot worse than this. Sure. But I mean, it's just crazy the things we don't know about, the things that aren't taught versus the things that are sometimes.
What we're going to come out of this mini pod is that 5 years from now, I will be proven super wrong. And I will come up to people and say, "Man, that movie was way better than I gave it credit for. I still gave it a B, though."
That's true.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I think for me, just discussing it with you guys, I think what issues I do have with it outside of the ending are that these just feel like characters he's done many times before, even though they're real people, but they're still Aaron Sorkin is writing them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they just feel like even Mark Rylance, I mean, he's not Daniel Caffey, but like at the same time, it's one of those things where like, I don't know, it feels kind of in that same vein, like he's... And also the thing about the Rylance character that did kind of bug me at times is like, he's one of those characters that is like so well-spoken, like he doesn't even hesitate. Like he always knows what to say.
I mean, that's Sorkin characters, man.
I get that. But at times that does get a little like, you know, you're like, I mean, come on, just like stumble over a word. I mean,
I don't think I'll ever get tired of that. I
don't know.
I love it.
Tired
so
of it. I think it's just over the years, I notice it more.
Sure. Sure.
In fact, I quit watching. I think West Wing was the one. I didn't make it all the way through West Wing because that started actually kind of getting on my nerves.
Well, like, neither did Sorkin. So
that's true. Maybe that's why too. Maybe that's what I love.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. What did you guys think of this movie? Go to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter. We're on SoundCloud. We're also on Discord. If you want to get on Discord, go to our Reddit page and find the link on the right side of the page there. Or you can go to Facebook and private message me and I can give you a link there. Where can we find other people, other fine people on this podcast?
Jonathan and I do a podcast with Danae Hughes. We are the B mm-hmm. team of Cinema Sins and we do Behind the Sins.
It I bet that's podcast. Fun.
It's mm-hmm. really fun, Chris.
Sounds real nice. Yeah.
It's a great time. Every week we break down the CinemaSins videos from the week and go a little bit behind the scenes at the Sins.
I hear mm-hmm. the SinCast is a good podcast as well. I should.
It isn't, but thank you. Thank you very much. All right. That's going to do it for this mini pod. It's Chris Atkinson, Barrett Scher, Aaron Dicer, and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
I do like that Whiplash poster.
Yeah, man.
I still don't like the movie, but I like the poster. It's a very nice poster. It makes me want to like the movie more.
I love looking at it.
How do you not like Whiplash? That movie is so good.
Oh, it drives me crazy. Oh, like
the anxiety thing.
Yeah, I can't take him yelling at him for 2 hours. It's too much.
Fair enough.
I just can't take it. I can appreciate it. Like, I know it's a good movie, but I can't watch it. Yeah, I think so too. And I'm Abby Hoffman. I'm pretty sure that was a name I knew
The interesting thing for me when I heard the name Abby Hoffman was I knew this is way off, but like, I knew that Gabby Hoffman, the actress, her mom was named Abby. And I thought when I heard Abby Hoffman, I thought, oh, is this possibly like a parent of hers? But mm-hmm. I thought it was the mom. So that's why I was like, okay, probably not. But yeah, Abby Hoffman, ended up writing a book called Steal This Book.
Yeah. I have mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
You have it.
Yeah.
That apparently is difficult to know how many actually sold because of that.
Yeah, they made a movie about this with Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo.
Really?
A long time ago. Yeah, well, a long time ago in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. It's a long time ago now.
That was a long time ago. I'm sorry to break the news to you.
Called The Truth About Cats and Dogs.
Yeah, it was 2000 that it came out. And,
oh, okay. Yeah, Vincent D'Onofrio,
Janine Garofalo, and Gene Triplehorn, Kevin Pollak, Donald Logue. Boy, that's 90s as shit.
Oh, well, that would make sense. Did Ben Stiller direct it, too?
No, I don't know why I thought Ben because Stiller.
That's a Ben Stiller show grouping there.
Yeah, yeah. Stiller's not in it.
And Stiller, yeah. Oh, is Stiller not in it?
No. I don't think so. No, I just thought about that because of the Janine Garofalo stuff.
Okay. So who was the guy that was in it?
It was Vincent D'Onofrio played him.
Oh, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Abby Hoffman. Yeah.
Okay. Because if it was Ben Stiller, this Gene Triplehorn was his old girlfriend, and Janine Garofalo was on the Ben Stiller
like
show.
It's a Ben Stiller thing, doesn't it?
It does.
Was Yesterday good?
Yeah, I liked it.
No.
I liked it a lot.
It's awful. It's horrible.
You're crazy. Are you being serious? Did you really not like it?
It's a waste. It's such a waste of a good concept. It makes no sense. Yesterday makes no sense.
What are you talking about? You're crazy.
Concept. The way they handle
you're
all
crazy,
this.
Man.
I love you.
I love you. But you're crazy. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkins. Well, I'm just going to fuck this up every time I do this.
It's just this week, man. It's just this week.
Jeez, fuck this.